Okay. Are all the recording devices all going? Great. So, yesterday we presented the Anapanasati Sutta as a way to fulfill the focuses of mindfulness, the Satipatthana. And there's one thing about the Satipatthana which sometimes people miss, and I sort of tried to quickly flip it up on my screen here yesterday, but just couldn't find it, so I'm going to start off with this little quote from the Samyutta Nikaya, from the Satipatthana Samyutta. In the Samyutta Nikaya, it groups all these teachings according to their subject. So even the Satipatthana, everything connected to that, they put in the Satipatthana Samyutta. So there's many interesting teachings there about the Satipatthana, so we can really understand exactly what the Buddha meant by these terms. And in particular, arise and fall, which many people practice Satipatthana, and they think rise and fall, they know what they're talking about, but this is how the Buddha meant it to be understood. This is from the 42nd Sutta of the 47th Samyutta in the Samyutta Nikaya. I will teach you the arising, samudaya, and the passing away, atagamana, of the four focuses of mindfulness. Supported by the four nutriments, there is the arising and continuance of the body. With the cessation of the four nutriments, the body ceases. The four nutriments are food, the six sense contacts, will, and consciousnesses. So where you read or hear, you're supposed to watch the rise of the body, the fall of the body, or the rise and the fall of the body, as in your body, so other bodies, or both. This is what the Buddha means, the causes why this body arises and continues, and why it ceases. And in particular, this is one of the most interesting of the contemplations, because for the rise of the body, and it's for its continuance, the four nutriments are food, which we can understand that if you don't eat, you'll fade away and die, but also six sense contacts. And this is important, because if you do ever see someone in a coma, say, and you feel that there may still be some life in them, if you don't talk to them, they may not be able to respond to you. If you don't even hold their hand or stroke their head, you don't give them any sensory stimulation, that is one of the reasons they will pass away. Without their senses being stimulated, then, especially the five senses, they will disappear. They will go. And of course, that is, many of you may have come across such situations. And maybe your mother, your father, grandma, someone you love very much, they're in the bed and they don't respond at all. Please talk to them if you want them to survive. Please tell them the latest news. Please hold their hand, stroke them, stimulate their senses, and then you're increasing their chances of survival. Without that sensory stimulation, they will die. And also that from a will. And of course, will, if you really want to live, I don't know how many of you have experienced that your loved one is in a hospital bed, and they're dying, and they keep on going on. They don't die yet, until some relation comes from overseas, and when they arrive from overseas, and they say goodbye, then the next hour or two they're gone. They die. It's as if they keep continuing on in this life because they really want to, the will is strong, and they carry on. On the other hand, you see, like couples who live together for such a long time, and when one dies, the other one dies shortly afterwards. Basically, they just don't want to live anymore. A will to live is also one of the nutriments. The last one is actually consciousness. So if there's not even the mind consciousness inside, obviously that is the body dies. So these are the four nutriments of the body. Namely again, it's food, basically sensory stimulation, will and consciousness. And when we get to the next Satipatthana of Vedana, which I translate as experience, most people understand this as feelings, but it doesn't matter, you know what I'm talking about here. Supported by just the six sense contacts, there is the arising experience. You do need sort of the basis, you need sight, which is working. You need hearing to have any experience. So that is pretty obvious. By the six sense contacts is arising experience. With the cessation of the six sense contacts, experience ceases. And one of the most crucial ones, third Satipatthana, where you contemplate the citta, the mind, is supported by nama rupa, literally the objects of consciousness. There is the arising of the citta, the mind. With the cessation of nama rupa, the citta ceases. And that's a very beautiful statement there, which shows that citta is not permanent even in this life. It arises according to things to be known. The nama rupa. And when the nama rupa ceases, so does the citta cease. And lastly, the dhamma objects of fourth, or the principles, supported by attention. There's the arising of these mind objects or principles. With cessation of attention, the mind objects cease. So especially the first and the third. This is what it means. It doesn't mean just rise and fall. It means why it rises, what causes its arising. When those things are taken away, it means these effects, what you're focusing your mindfulness on, ceases too. Okay, so now we go on to having talked about the right mindfulness. Then the next one is the right stillness, Sama Samadhi, which is coming up soon. Oops, I went right past it. Sorry?
Can you see okay?
Yeah. My sight base is are working in full order. Right stillness. Starting off with the passage from the Arya Pariyasana Sutta, the search, it's the Buddha's story of his enlightenment. I remember a time where my father was occupied while I was sitting in the cool shade of a rose apple tree. Having passed beyond the five senses, and free from unwholesome states, I entered and abided in the first jhana. I thought, could that be the path to awakening, to Bodhi? Then the realization arose, that jhana is indeed the path to awakening. And there's a couple of big points there, but this is where the Buddha, having tried all sorts of methods, all sorts of exertions, decided that to remember going back to the time when his father was doing what they say these days is a ploughing ceremony. And so this little kid sat under a tree. Now first of all, little children are not noted for their striving, putting forth efforts. Very well known for their allowing themselves just to be still and be peaceful and be quiet. So, the Buddha, a Bodhisattva they call it, when very young, attained this jhana. And now it took all this time before the Buddha remembered that and said, could that be the path to awakening? Then the realization arose, that jhana is indeed the path to Bodhi. So what are these four jhanas? This having abandoned the five hindrances, totally free from the five senses. That's vivicchehi kamehi, vivicca akusalehi dhammehi. The akusala dhammas, unwholesome states in this context, refers to being free from the five hindrances. Totally free, not just restraining them, not just weakening them, but seeing them totally disappear. Freeing from the five senses. Again, this is a translation, vivicchehi kamehi. K long A M A for karma refers to the five sense world. It does not refer to sensory pleasure, which is kama sukha. And it is well used throughout the Pali canon that when you see that word karma, K long A M A, I spell it to distinguish it from the law of kama, K A double M A. Whenever you see that, it does refer to the five senses, such as Kamaloka, the five sense world. So this is totally free from the five senses. You can't hear, see, smell, taste, or touch. Free from unwholesome states, you enter upon and abide in the first jhana, wherein the mind moves onto the object and holds on to it. This is the word vitaka vichara, which in some cases does mean thinking. But in this case of the jhanas, it's much more refined than that. In the same sense that dog usually means a canine, a cat usually means something which goes meow meow, and in most contexts that's what it means. But in the context it rained cats and dogs, it does not mean that at all. The words are defined by their context. They don't have an individual, essential meaning in themselves. And it's very clear that with Suddhimagga, at least there, they say it's like, was it banging a gong is vitaka and the resonance is the vichara. That is a little bit closer to the experience of the jhanas. So your mind is moving on to the object and still holds on to it. The object, what is your mind object in the first jhana? It is not the breath, it is not the nimittas, it is the pleasure, the joy. The object being joy and pleasure caused by being totally free from the five senses. That is the source of the joy in the first jhana. And so straight away I hope that you could understand that when you emerge from those jhanas and you look back upon them, you will realize what is missing and what was there. And it's what is missing is five senses. You can't hear, you can't see, you can't smell, taste, or physical touch. It's not as if that those five senses are there and you can turn to them whenever you want. It's like they're all turned off. And you can't find where the switch is to turn it back on again. They're distant from you. And that is beautiful. Very easy to say, oh, this body is suffering. Very easy to say the body is like living in a prison. But it's true. You know why I can prove that your body is like a prison? Because it's made up of cells. But when this body vanishes, oh, that's really a lot of happiness. So that's the reason. So you here, when you talk about suffering, you understand what it means in a very profound experiential way. in a first jhana, you're having a happy, wonderful time. That's why even the Buddha said, when he was really old, really struggling to sort of walk and to see, he said his body was worn out, like just an old cart held together by straps. He said the only time he really has any freedom from that suffering of a body is when he enters the jhanas. It's free. In the first jhana, five things are absent and five factors are present. But when it's entered the first jhana, the five hindrances are totally absent. Doesn't want anything. That's the first hindrance, wanting. Who wants anything when you've got this beautiful pleasure? Ill will. You're having too good a time to have any ill will. Sloth and torpor. Ooh, you're energized, really empowered. Could you have sloth and torpor if you've had six cups of coffee together with a couple of Red Bulls? This guy in the train the other day was sobbing like that.
More.
Yeah. This is where you focus as well, really energized. Yeah. And but that's with restlessness. He was really restless. But here you're just so poised. Totally energized. Just poised. And it's like a Ferrari. A Ferrari car. Whose? Our engine is running and just ready to take your feet off the brake. Vroom! Is that a good simile? Probably not, anyway. That's how I get the similes. I make them up, try them out, I notice which work, I keep. They don't work, I put them in the rubbish bin. And, so five hindrances are gone, totally absent. What is present? Oh, the other one which is gone also is doubt. That is a weird one of the hindrances which we don't usually talk too much about. But here, you've got your experience and really clear. You're not sort of have a dull mind. The mind is really precise. And so it's not as if you can ever imagine that you are concocting these states. And the other place in which I think of the guy House mentioned this, that when you have these jhanas, the doubt is totally eradicated for a long time. But if you come out afterwards, and if you do these other little things like recollecting your previous lives, which you can do, then if you do remember anything, what you remember is clear and accurate. You have no doubt, which is a weird part of it. You know that was you. You know, sometimes when you have memories, the memories are a bit fuzzy. Sometimes if you have recollections of previous lives through hypnosis, hypnotherapy, hypnotic regression. Even there, maybe it's me, maybe it's not me. But when you get to these recollections in meditation after jhanas, wow, you have no doubt in the world. That was you. It's weird. Just as much as I know that I'm here right now and today, I had my lunch with Ayachanda and with Ajahn Brahm, the other Ajahn Brahm, not this Ajahn Brahm. So this, that clarity is one of the amazing things when you get these recollections of past lives, you know, past the deep meditations. Because the hindrance of doubt is gone. So those are gone in the jhana. And what things are, five things are present. The mind moving on to the object, I'll explain why that's going on in a moment, holds on to it, object being joy and pleasure, and is a oneness of mind. Oneness of mind, it says ekagata. And it's not ekagata, but ekagata. Which means not a one-pointedness of mind, but a one peak of mind. Aga is a word meaning summit, peak, top, capital, to the point that its Sanskrit equivalent is called Agra. And many of you have probably been to the Red Fort or the Taj Mahal in Agra, which was the capital of the Mughal Empire. So it does not mean just oneness, it means one special peak of mind, Agra. So this is a oneness of mind, it's an amazing unity of mind, not any ordinary unity, but really peak of awareness. When the mind no longer moves on to the object, as it lets go of holding on to it. You enter upon the abide in the second jhana, which has trust in the object, the bliss, enough to let go of holding it, and unity of mind without any movement or holding, with joy and pleasure caused by absolute stillness. So, what is happening in the first jhana? You've left the five senses behind because you're looking at this beautiful mind object, the piti sukha, caused by abandoning the five senses, but still a holding of it. Because you're holding on to it, there is that little bit left of grasping, it becomes unstable. Grasping moves things. I haven't got my cup. You know the cup? This is a virtual cup,
what,
okay?
This cup?
Where is he? Where's the other one? Okay. When you hold things, it always moves. So when the person in the first jhana still holding on to the piti sukha, it would always move slightly. But it moves away, and then it's so beautiful it sucks you straight back in. So it's what I call the wobble of the first jhana. And so, but that's hardly anything at all. But after a while, you trust enough, you don't need to hold anything. And when you stop holding on to it, which that's the vichara, then of course it doesn't move anywhere, so the vitaka is just not necessary anymore. The mind doesn't move onto the object anymore. And that explains something which is what's called that jhana between the first and the second, the one and a half jhanas, which is called, which is where it is no vitaka but with the vichara. So you don't move away from the object, but there is still a tiny bit left of holding, not enough to disturb the unity. But of course, once you have enough confidence, the word is sampasada, you have enough confidence, then you don't need to hold on to it. That object is totally stable and the mind doesn't move on to it, doesn't leave it. That's where the vitaka vichara totally gone. Why is it gone? Because you have that total confidence. You can let go. You don't need to do anything. So this is that second jhana. It doesn't move on to the object, it lets go of holding on to it. We enter upon the abide in the second jhana, which has trust in the object, the bliss. Enough to you have by the second jhana which has trust in the object being bliss, enough to let go of holding it, and unity of mind without any movement or holding, with joy and pleasure caused by absolute stillness. Now that's the it's like they call it samadhija, piti sukha. And the first jhana is vivekaja, piti sukha. Vivekaja means born of the being aloof, being apart, being separated from the five senses. This is like samadhija, piti sukha. It's another flavor of bliss, but obviously much more refined, of absolute stillness. And that is the defining feature of the second jhana. You really are still now. You're like a diamond, like a rock, like a mountain which cannot be moved. It's not that you decide to hold yourself still. It's not you decide to move. That apparatus of decision is gone. There is no will there. People can actually not exert their will. They can choose just to let go and let things be. But here you've got no choice. The will has disappeared. Someone's stolen the mouse of your computer. It does not respond to any pressing of buttons. It's stuck. Beautifully stuck, I would say. In beautiful pretty sukha. And if any of you have the opportunity and the good luck to get into any of these states, first of all, we have this terrible thing called spiritual materialism, which means we really want to get these states, and a lot of times there's some self left there, so one says, well, you know, it was sort of still. That counts, doesn't it? Please, 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 please. So of all the teachers, apparently there's a book somewhere, and they gave a table of meditation teachers, especially jhana teachers. And who are the toughest examiners? Who sets the highest standards before they were confirmed, yes, that was first jhana? And apparently in the table, someone showed me the five monks, or nuns, I think Ayakema was number five. So she's pretty easy if you want to have your jhana confirmed. Her standards are a little bit lower. But unfortunately, she's dead. And I forget who the fourth and third ones were, but the second one was Par Ok Sayadaw. It's pretty tough to get your jhana confirmed by Par Ok. But the toughest of all, the one, if he says you've got jhana, then all the other ones certainly will, was. You're sitting in front of me right now, Ajahn Brahm. The toughest examiner. So I don't let sort of almost jhanas get by. So you have to be really still. There's no will left there at all. And the second jhana, can't find it. You're frozen. It's not scary. It's beautiful. After that, you have the insight. Your will is not your friend. We're more attached to our will than our body. It's our will which we think can give us freedom of choice, safety, the pursuit of what we feel is happiness. And this is scary stuff. When you realize your will doesn't belong to you, it's not a friend at all, it's a source of great suffering. That changes a lot of how you look at the world. And also, the simile is that the will is like a prison guard. And you're the prisoner in this jail with five high walls, each one representing one of the five senses. And the will never leaves you alone. Always telling you to do something. Tend to think, to plan, to do something. And as soon as you're quiet, will comes up and disturbs you. It's your control freak, and it's not belonging to you at all. So, if the will, you get the will to fall asleep, to be disappear for a while, wow, you don't need to move. Peace at last. All this coming and going, all coming from your will, ceases. That's pretty cool. Anyway, that's not the end yet. So you're blissing out through stillness. With the fading away of joy, you abide mindful and fully aware. Experience of bliss purified from joy, you enter upon and abide in the third jhana, on account of which noble ones announce one has a pleasant abiding indeed, who has such mindfulness and equanimity. Now, is what's happening there? Do you remember what I was saying about when things are still, something disappears after a while? Looking at that whitewashed wall in Throstle Hole Priory in the Zen retreat, I wasn't doing anything. It's because I was not doing anything, the wall vanished. Cool. So you have this pity sukha of second jhana, you're absolutely still now, and after a while something vanishes. It's just a coarser part of bliss, pity. And some people ask me, what's the difference between pity and sukha? They always go together for most of existence, so it's hard to tell the difference. They're almost inseparable, except from second to third jhana. That's the only place you can really say you know the difference. You don't need to actually to try and get words to describe that difference. It's just a finer more calmer form of bliss. And then the fourth jhana, having abandoned pleasure and pain, that's all Vedana, experience from the five senses. You do that before entering the jhanas. And with the disappearance of joy and happiness, that's all Vedana from the six senses except for equanimity. So this, all those six senses, they have the good, the bad, and the in-between. All of that has been disappeared except the in-between, the equanimity, the contentment of the sixth sense, the mind. So when we go from the third to the fourth, this is the fourth that's almost like summing up so the whole practice, having abandoned pleasure and pain from the five senses, that was done before the first jhana. But now summing up the fourth jhana, you're at the end of these, this particular set of meditations, so you can't feel the five senses anymore. So there's no pleasure, no pain, no in-between. And even in the mind, no pleasure, no suffering. Pure contentment. Real peace, stillness. And which has only neutral mental vedana remaining, and this is the phrase always want to emphasize, just pure mindfulness with equanimity. There's a purity of mindfulness of that fourth jhana. It is not that you're unconscious. It's not that you don't know what's happening. You are fully aware. More aware than you've ever experienced before. Pure mindfulness. That's the fourth jhana. And I mentioned a little bit earlier what in the question time, what happens next. Stay long enough in the fourth jhana and other things start to disappear. The will has disappeared. There's only one thing left to disappear. The mental consciousness. The mind starts to unravel like peeling an onion. Disappearing more and more and more. And you can't stop it. Your will has disappeared a long time ago. You're out of control. Woohoo! Having a wonderful time. Anyway, and what kind of meditation did the Buddha recommend? This is from the Gopika Moggallana Sutra. This was a sutra which you can actually know when it was delivered, because it was just after the Buddha's Parinibbana, when Ananda, the attendant of the Buddha, was literally the go-to person when people went to see how to do the funerals and what to do next. And Ananda, being with the Buddha for such a long time, 25 years before he passed away, Ananda was his attendant. And so he had a huge knowledge of what the Buddha taught. And Gopika Moggallana, after the Buddha passed away, before the cremation, the Mahaparinibbana, just asked him, "And what kind of meditation did the Buddha recommend?" And Ananda answered, "Totally free from the five senses, you abide in the first jhana. When the mind stops moving on to the joy and pleasure and stops holding it, you abide in the second jhana. You abide in the third jhana. You abide in the fourth jhana. The Buddha only praises four kinds of meditation." And that's very powerful. It's just so clear in the suttas. That's the only type of meditation which the Buddha praised. Jhanas. Yeah, but surely you get attached. Well, in the 29th sutta of Digha Nikaya, Sampasadana sutta, was it? Or was it Pasadika sutta? There are chunda, not chanda, but chunda. These four kinds of life devoted to pleasure. Four kinds of life devoted to pleasure that are entirely conducive to repulsion from the world, fading away, cessation, peace, realization, awakening to nirvana. What are they? The four jhanas. So if devotees of other sects should say that the Buddhists are addicted to these four forms of pleasure seeking, they should be told, yes, for they will be speaking correctly about you. We're addicts. We're jhana junkies. Anyway, they'll be speaking correctly about you. Then some people might further ask you, what benefits can you expect from a life attached to these four forms of pleasure seeking? You should reply that they can expect only four fruits, four benefits. One, stream winning. Two, once returning. Three, non-returning. Four, full awakening. These are the benefits that you can expect from being attached to these four forms of pleasure seeking. As I said, a pretty good deal. There is one path only, Ananda. One way to the abandoning of the five basic fetters. Sometimes they call them the five lower fetters and the five higher fetters, making 10 fetters in all. But I just railed against higher fetters. All fetters are really base and low and terrible. So I call them the five basic fetters. Those five basic fetters are kaya ditti, which is the belief that somewhere in here is a permanent essence, either in the body, in Vedana, in your experience, in perception, in will, in any of the consciousnesses, that somewhere there's something which is permanent, everlasting, survives everything, even survives Nibbana. There's something permanent which never ends. That is called Sakaya Ditti. It's one of the fetters which stop you being an Aryan, seeing the Dhamma. And skeptical doubt, and the belief that you can become enlightened solely through doing rites, rituals, practices. Please excuse me, like doing the Amitofu. That's all people need to do. Just chant the name of Amitabha so many times and you become enlightened. Unfortunately, the Buddha said that is smack bang in the middle of Sakaya Ditti. Not Sakaya Ditti, Siddhabhata Paramasa. So it's much more than that to become enlightened. So, those are the first three fetters. And the fourth fetter is Kamaraga, which is basically desire, lust, craving, wanting, within the realm of the five senses. And avyapada, ill will. So vyapada, so not avyapada. Vyapada, ill will. Those are the five basic fetters. And what the Buddha said, this is from one of the most clear suttas where the Buddha says you can't get enlightened without the jhanas. There's one path only, Ananda, one path to the abandoning of the five basic fetters, that's towards the sense of being an anagami. It is impossible that anyone can understand, yet alone abandon these five basic fetters without relying on that path. And an interesting point is you don't even know what these fetters are until you can practice this path. And once you know them, I know you, then you can abandon them. No more than it is possible to cut out the hardwood from a tree without first cutting through its bark and sapwood. When I first heard that, I thought there must be some way to get to the bark of a tree. Being an arrogant, scientifically trained elitist, privileged Westerner, I could find a way. And I started to think of how you can get to the hardwood without sapwood and the bark being damaged, and I couldn't find a way. It's the same to understand what I mean. sometimes I say, you know, it's impossible to actually to kiss your own elbow. And somebody tries. Yes. If you don't try now, when you go into your room, you give it a go. That must be somewhere. I'll do yoga. I'll be able to do it. You can't do it. That's the Buddha said, you can't cut out. So we'll give it a try. You can't do it. So it's impossible to cut out the hardwood from a tree without first cutting through its bark and sapwood. What is that path which you need to abandon the five basic fetters and to actually know them? It is the four jhanas and the first three of these immaterial attainments. Not the last of the immaterial attainments, which is neither perception nor non-perception. That is far too refined. That's almost, you almost ceased. Everything is almost gone. It's very hard to actually to base any reflections back on that to actually break through to enlightenment. While you still do not experience jhana, the five hindrances, together with discontent and weariness, invade your mind and remain. But when you do experience the jhana, the five hindrances, discontent and weariness, do not invade your mind and remain. That is one of the purposes of the jhanas, to actually to suppress the five hindrances, not for just a minute or two, but for long hours of time, giving the clarity, the power to be able to understand the Dhamma. There's also that discontent and weariness don't come into the picture after you've attained the jhana, which is sometimes, I think I'll let you into my old tricks, I have to invent new tricks these days, because sometimes I've already mentioned that I'm one of the toughest examiners to approve any jhanas. So one of my tricks is you may come up to me and tell me that you've got a jhana, and I'll look at you and say, I'm sorry, women can't attain jhanas. And I look. If that pushes any button, then it wasn't a jhana. Anyway. Okay. Oh, it may have been. Congratulations. Of course women can get jhanas. You only say that thing to try and see if I can get any discontent in you at all. Any little trick to try and make you upset. Not because I want to hurt you, but it makes it very clear whether you have, you know, these jhanas or not. Because after you've got a jhana, nothing can upset you. You know, until the time the five hindrances are gone, people call you a stupid fat old monk. Oh yeah, that's got some point behind that. And weariness. That's gone too. So you're full of energy. Have a wonderful time. And now, just to make a point, I really pushed these points, but it needs to be pushed because some people still think that jhana has no place on the Eightfold Path. You can get in line without jhanas, which is total gomayang. I did tell you what gomayang means, didn't I?
Not here.
Okay. Go is the Pali word for ball. Mayang is what comes out of the back end of the ball. But because people keep on saying, Ajahn Brahm, your words are just too crude. They expect me to be like a vicar, always saying just lovely words, well spoken. And I rebel against that. Even the Buddha said you should speak in the local language. As you speak outside, so I speak here. I'm a working class monk. I still work. Anyway, what am I doing? Oh yeah, let's go, Maya. To say you can, the jhanas have no place. Because the Buddha says it again and again and again and again and again and again and again. Anyway, while you still are yesterday, when you have no jhana, for one deficient in jhana, the cause for seeing things as they truly are is destroyed. When you do not see things as they truly are, for one deficient in such wisdom, the cause for repulsion and fading away is destroyed. When you do not repulse nor incline to disappearing, for one deficient in these, the cause for knowledge and vision of liberation is destroyed. The Buddha was just so clear about that. And sometimes people get a little bit confused because while you are in the jhanas, there is no thinking possible. So how can you get insight in such a deep state of stillness when everything is like frozen? And it is true that no one gets enlightened within the jhanas, but they do not get enlightened without the jhanas. The jhanas are the condition, one of the necessary conditions for the attainment of penetration insight. It's based on those jhanas. And when one comes out afterwards, in that state post-jhana, the hindrances are gone, mind is clear, not weary, can't get upset. It gives you the opportunity to actually get really great insights. And the piece of advice which I give you is, if you do have those jhanas or one of them, and you look back afterwards, those jhanas are very easy to recall. I've not many words in English to describe this, but it's like traumatic, only always positive. If you've had some sort of injury, a car accident, or some really awful experience in your life, it's so difficult to forget it. It's almost branded with a hot iron into your brain. And you can't forget it. But we use that trauma, that post-traumatic stress syndrome, whatever it is, but we use that in a purely negative way. We don't have the words to describe a totally positive experience of the same intensity, which you cannot forget, and you don't want to forget. And that's one of the reasons why that people who have these experiences, if they haven't had them explained before, they just keep going around and around until they find a teacher who can explain it to them. You can't dismiss it. It's powerful. It's branded into your brain. Very positive, though. And so afterwards, it's very easy to recollect them. What they were, what happened. We use that. That is your database. The mind, now, after jhanas, really no hindrances. It's a mind which can really reflect and find out the meaning of those states. That is where you get the enlightenment from. Nati jhana apanyasa panya nati ajarato yam hi jhana chapanya chasa ve nibbana santi ke. Please excuse me once again for showing off. Because still some days we'll say, Ajahn Brahm makes all this up himself. That is from the Dhammapada, that is verse 372, I think. The one I said the other day is, I think, verse 274 or something. This was that there is no jhana without wisdom. Use wisdom power, not willpower, to get in these jhanas. Nati jhana apanyasa. Panya nati ajayato. There is no wisdom without the jhana. First was no jhana without wisdom, no wisdom without jhana. And a beautiful phrase at the end. Yam hi jhanam cha panya cha. And the one who has jhana and wisdom. Sawe nibbana santike. They are in the presence of nibbana. And knocking on the door. Boom! Something's going to explode. And all those hindrances are going to get disappeared. Anyway, so just to be sure, because it's been a long time, since Ajahn Chah passed away and since he stopped teaching. In fact, Ajahn Chah had his stroke about a month after I went to Australia. And after that, didn't teach at all. And not with words. But you know what? After he was still alive, but he had, you know, in a stroke. You know that sometimes you have these amazing dreams, these lucid dreams? And I dreamt, you know, that Ajahn Chah was giving me a special teaching. He's had a stroke at this time, he hadn't died yet. And I, in the dream, you know, you're aware of what's going on. I thought, wow, this is really a very important teaching, very powerful. And I made the resolution in the dream, I've got to remember this. It's important. And then the teaching stopped, and I woke up in my cave. You know what happened afterwards? Couldn't remember a word of it. That was so frustrating. Well, never mind, that's the first thing that happened. Anyway, he taught me enough when I was alive, so that was okay. But I went to go and see Ajahn Jayasaro, who was a good friend, and he was the one who did the translation of Ajahn Chah's biography, and added a few more bits in as well, added to the stories and life of Ajahn Chah. And I just happened to be in Thailand at the time, and I just gave him a call, can I come up, have a visit? Oh yeah, great, really great if you can come and visit, because he was just finishing off the biography. And he wanted, because I was with Ajahn Chah for 9 years, so I had a lot of information about the life of Ajahn Chah. And so I had a wonderful little afternoon together, and I took the opportunity, should have recorded these things, but took the opportunity to actually to ask him, did Ajahn Chah teach jhanas? He said, yes, of course he did. But he gave those jhanas the name of the Abhidharma name, which is called Apana Samadhi. So he taught jhanas, he gave it a different name. That's because the name it has almost in common usage in Thai meditation teachers. Great. First tick. Next, he said, what about when you get enlightened? When does that happen, according to Ajahn Chah's teaching? And he said, Ajahn Chah, sorry, this is from listening to so many talks. He said, we don't get enlightened within the jhanas. It's usually in what they call in the commentarial literature, the upachara, which is either before or after the jhanas. And I said, well, which one? He said, Ajahn Chah said, afterwards, after you've emerged from jhanas, when the five hindrances are gone. You just had an amazing experience. I remembered my teacher's instructions correctly. That's how Ajahn Chah taught. So please remember that. And so, develop jhana. When you experience jhana, you can understand things as they really are. And what you understand as it really is? The origin and passing away of form, the origin and passing away of experience, the origin and passing away of perception, the origin and passing away of will, the origin and passing away of consciousnesses. That neither these, any of these five components of existence, they come and go according to conditions. None of them is permanent. When the causes go, so do they. That thing which you call consciousness is not going to be everlasting. It is subject to dissolution. Whatever arises is subject to passing away. All of you. That's one of the reasons why when the Buddha taught the Dhammacakka Sutta, the first disciple of Kondanya understood all those things which arise because of the course are subject to ceasing, including your will, including your consciousnesses, including your mind. I don't want to go. And you find that so many people resist these teachings because they work so hard to get enlightened. Can't I enjoy it afterwards? Can't I have some little place, some tiny little corner of samsara where I can live happily ever after? Unfortunately, this is not a Walt Disney movie. Where Prince Charming and the Nimitta ride into the sunset and live happily ever after. Oh, I did actually have, there was no giant one without wisdom. Yeah. I'm just going to go quickly now to finish off to, there's one of the other ones which I just really wanted to make sure I quoted. It's on page 7 of my book. Before I came here, I searched for it and I found it. I know it's in here somewhere, but it's coming soon. Patience is one of the great virtues, said the Buddha, and it also allows me to ad lib until I find what I really want to talk about. One of the great things about being a monk is you learn how to ad lib when something else, when looking for something. Hey, oh my goodness. Must be 17. Da 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 da. Huh? It's not here. Mara stops you getting into. Oh, here we go. This is Samyutta Nikaya. The 18th Samyutta, which is the about the senses, the Ayatanas. Sariyatiya Samyutta. Because I remember just, I've got a really good offsider assistant with Ajahn Bhumali. I taught him Pali, and it's wonderful to teach other people how to do things, because now I can ask him to get me all the quotes. So you read these things, but trying to find out where these things are in the suttas. So I asked him, in all of your readings of these sutras, where does it say the most clearly that after Nibbana, Parinibbana, there's nothing left? And he gave me this one from the Salayatana Samyutta. An arahat, fully enlightened being, understands that the six senses, sight, hearing, smell, taste, touch, and the mind will cease completely and totally without remainder, and no other senses will arise anywhere in any way. This is another way one knows that there is nothing more to be done, an arahat. And I will leave the word of the Buddha there so you can have a cup of tea. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Very good. Okay, so I hope you enjoyed that. After the cup of tea, then we will have a little bit of a final talk and a metta meditation, and that will be followed by just a talk about the Anukampa, practical stuff. So, cup of tea, or go to the toilet, or have a walk around, or whatever you need to do. Hi.
I was making these.
This is something I said.
No, my afternoon is coming back to Vienna.
Oh, okay, very good.
Thank you so much. It was so lovely to see you.
Good to see you again. Well, thank you so much.
Real good. Soon again.
Yeah, time passes quickly.
Okay, going.
Catching the plane.